This episode was co-produced with Splint Invest, a regulated Swiss financial institution that helps private investors diversify their portfolio by providing easy access to alternative investments like art, luxury watches, and rare whiskey. With the Splint Invest app, you can start investing with as little as 50 Swiss francs.
On May 22nd, we'll be doing a live stream with former Swisspreneur guest Aurelio Perucca about how to make money from alternative investments. Tune in at 12 p.m. CET on May 22nd via LinkedIn, Facebook, or YouTube to watch me and Aurelio get down to the nitty-gritty of alternative investments. You'll find a link in the show notes directing you to the LinkedIn event. Click attend so you don't miss it.
What has building Tilremo taught you so far?
The relative nature of the word impossible.
Nice, I like that.
Welcome to the Swisspreneur Show, a podcast about startup stories and learnings from experienced entrepreneurs. If you enjoy listening to our show, make sure to follow the podcast and leave a rating. And now, here's your host, Sylvain.
Stephanie, a very welcome to the Swisspreneur Show. It's a pleasure to have you as a guest today.
Thanks for having me.
You're the co-founder and CEO at Tilremo Therapeutics, a biotech startup on a mission to prevent non-genetic cancer drug resistance. Before we talk about your company, I actually want to start with your personal background. You got your master's and your PhD from ETH. Was it there that you caught the entrepreneurial bug, or was that already running in your family or something like that?
It was certainly during that time, though when I did my master's and my PhD studies day, I didn't do it because thinking that I would ever found a company based on our research, but It was purely because I love doing science. Yeah. And the company was just sort of a consequence of that.
Okay. And do you think that you would have been equally satisfied if you had remained a researcher to this day?
Probably. I am usually a very happy person, so I'd probably also be happy working at Migro stocking shelves. Yeah. It's all a matter of your mindset, I think.
I like that. So let's look at the year 2017 when you actually founded your company. You were 5 co-founders in total. Mm-hmm. Please take us back to this day and this time. How did you meet your co-founders?
So the first co-founder I had was Professor Willie Craig. He was a professor at ETH in cell signaling. So a very famous professor. And we started this program together. And when we started, we're like, all right, you know, we're really good at the science, but if we want to develop cancer drugs, we probably need somebody who can actually do that. So we reached out to another ETH prof, Karl-Heinz Altmann, who is also the former global head of chemistry at Novartis. So he already knew how to develop cancer drugs in a sort of in a pharmaceutical environment. And then we were joined by Isaac Coburn, who was the former chief medical officer of Actelion. So he brought in sort of the clinical development expertise. And Emmanuel Savio was the 5th co-founder then, who is an entrepreneur by trade, or an entrepreneur and finance guy. So he helped me write the first business plans and do the financial modeling.
Yeah. And you seem to have a very strong team with the background, the experience that you brought to the table. Were all people involved working full-time from the start, or how did that setup look like?
I was actually the only one who was operationally involved in the company. They were really instrumental at, you know, helping me shape the company and the business plan and really lending their name to validate what we do.
Sure.
And that was key for us to raise money, a lot of money relatively fast after foundation. But then it was basically up to me to build the operational team and get the actual work done.
How do you set a company up where you have really important and knowledgeable people, but that are not operationally involved? Do you give them a similar amount of shares, or how do you incentivize them? Do you let them invest? How did you solve that? Because I imagine that's a big first initial challenge to get off the ground.
I mean, in our case, I think we're all intrinsically really motivated because we saw the scientific and clinical promise of the idea. In terms of founder shares, I got the most because, you know, I also had the biggest risk, right? So I was the one who, of course, had the biggest risk because it's an opportunity cost, right? I could have gotten a job at Roche instead.
Sure.
But motivating them to help was never really an issue. It's just about you making sure that you ask those questions that you need to ask and executing on that.
Got it. And I assume you have the standard clauses with like vesting, et cetera, to also protect the company in that regard.
Yeah, you have a reverse vesting if somebody leaves. And I think that's important when you set up a company. Yeah. But of course, a lot of also based on trust, right? You of can't course. Protect against any potential downside.
Yeah. I think it's a really exciting story to hear how you set up the company. But then, tragically, you also had setbacks to deal with, and a very big one. Your co-founder, Willy, he passed away 1 year after you founded the company. What was it like to deal with this loss while still having to keep Tolrimo afloat, basically?
It was very tragic, obviously, very sad on multiple levels. You know, personally, he was my mentor, basically. He was... Mm-hmm. My scientific adversary almost. We spent countless hours discussing science, mostly arguing about science, and I would disagree with him and he would disagree with me and I would be annoyed with him and he would be annoyed with me, and it was beautiful, right, the scientific discourse. Yeah. And that all of a sudden was gone. Mm. And it was also for me, he had already founded a company before. So he was a little bit my rock in the beginning, you know, we can figure this out together. Yeah. And that was gone. And you still have a team to lead, though, right? You have a responsibility to them. You have a responsibility to your shareholders. By the time he passed away, we were just about to close the first tranche of our Series A, which was 10 million Swiss francs. So you have a responsibility to these people, and you have a responsibility to the science a little bit, right? What we'd built together. So you just have to, you know, keep going. but I still think of him a lot. Still today.
That's beautiful. And I wonder, you know, it must have been devastating to deal with that loss. At the same time, you kept the company afloat until today. Has it ever crossed your mind to shut down, to sort of give up, or even more so, you wanted to make it happen also for Willy at the same time?
Yeah, I'm not somebody who gives up easily. Yeah. Also because I do feel, you know, it is a big responsibility and you do have a lot of people trusting you. Mm-hmm. And especially when it comes to seed rounds, they don't give money to the company. They often give money to you as the CEO that they trust.
Right. Yeah.
And so that's just, you know, what you sign up for when you do this kind of work.
So giving up was never really an option.
Not an option. And I think he'd be disappointed too, you know, because we've put so much work and thought and love into this. He would want us to keep going for sure.
Great. And the discoveries that eventually then led to your company, to the foundation of Tolrimo, were done at ETH. In what ways did the university actually support the project? Because you always hear and read a lot about the ETH support and the, you know, ecosystem at ETH. How did that look like for you from a very practical side?
I think initially it's really just being at ETH, and I mean, you do feel it's a very special place. It's very scientifically creative. But I think that really comes down to the individual prof and the individual lab.
Yeah.
And in our case, I had sort of total scientific freedom in whatever I wanted to do. Not a lot of financial restrictions, so you can really go crazy with your ideas. And of course, that sparks, you know, lays the foundation for new discoveries. Mm-hmm. It was later than then when we're thinking about, okay, founding, how can we actually capture the value of just a scientific mechanism that we identified? That's when ETH was really important. How do we patent this? Connecting us to IP attorneys, helping us write the patent. And that, of course, is extremely valuable, because without that, you're not going to get your science out of a lab and into a company setting.
Yeah, and they had done that multiple times before, so they knew how the process would look like.
Exactly. You have a professional tech transfer office. They can connect you to the right people. They know what the right steps are to found. And this, of course, also specifically in the seed round in Switzerland, the name of ETH gives you certain, people know your science is probably of certain quality. Yeah. And that certainly helps getting things off the ground as well.
Is there any area where you would have wished for more support financially, project-wise, resource-wise?
I think financially, personally, I'm not of the opinion that a public institution should finance private companies. Mm-hmm. It's really up to you as an entrepreneur to make sure that your project gets funded.
Exactly.
And it is possible in Switzerland. Resource-wise, at least in our lab at ETH, that was never an issue, really. Mm-hmm. I think it's mainly, and I do think that they're working on this now, just being exposed to the idea that you could potentially use your science to actually help patients, right?
Yeah.
In my mind, we were total nerds in the lab just pipetting away because we loved it. Mm-hmm. But maybe getting this thought into people's heads, hey, you can actually do good with the work that you do. I think that is certainly something that they can still improve on a little bit.
And I think you coming on a podcast to talk about exactly that journey and serving as a role model is another fantastic step in that direction.
That's what I'm here for.
Perfect. So let's talk about the technical aspects behind your company. We are all non-scientists here. So please explain to us, you know, the difference between genetic and non-genetic cancer drug resistance as if we were 5 years old.
So maybe just drug resistance in cancer in general, which is something that people are oftentimes not aware of, is one of the biggest problems we have in the clinic. So we have a lot of cancer therapies, though they usually work for a couple of months or years. That means the tumor would shrink again, though oftentimes, after a certain time, the therapy fails and tumors, they start growing back, even though patients would still take these drugs. So that's the problem of drug resistance that we have that really limits long-term benefit for these patients.
Mm-hmm.
And drug resistance can develop because of, as you mentioned, genetic causes or non-genetic causes. And you can think of it a little bit as maybe a little advanced for a 5-year-old, but a 15-year-old.
Okay.
You would have genetic causes are basically hardware defects in the cell. So the DNA that has a mutation that's broken. Non-genetic causes is anything that's not related to the DNA. So these are transcriptional changes, so the genes that are expressed, or metabolic changes, basically the cell starting to behave differently. So these are your software changes.
Mm-hmm.
And to address this, classically, people would look at these hardware changes because you can measure it. It's static. It's always there. You can develop a drug against it.
Yeah.
Whereas non-genetic changes software is a lot more dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
So there you have the question, okay, how can you capture it and how can you measure it and how can you actually develop chemistry against it if everything just keeps moving?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're really good at because, you know, we've been studying this for 15 years and developed a lot of technology on how you can actually exploit these mechanisms to help patients.
And talking about the hardware defect, so to speak, is there anything that you can do if the hardware is defected?
In cancer, what is done, so as a consequence of your hardware defect of your mutated DNA, the cell will produce a mutated protein,
mm-hmm.
protein that just looks a little funny, which causes the cancer drug though to be ineffective. Like it might have a certain binding pocket that the cancer drug would fit into, but if that binding pocket is mutated and looks weird, the cancer drug can't bind anymore, so it's not effective. And that's what people have been trying to do. The problem, though, is, you know, once you already have this genetic, this mutation, the hardware that's defective, it's kind of too late already, right? Your problem's already there. Your server or your hard drive is already blown up.
Yeah.
So fixing that is difficult. With the software effects, they're, of course, they're much more dynamic, right? And you can actually fix them ideally before your whole system blows up.
Perfect. And now, I, of course, want to know how you go in there and fix the software defect. So how does Tolremo prevent non-genetic resistance to cancer drugs?
So we, back at ETH, identified a very central mechanism on how cells change their behavior and how they become resistant in response to being exposed to a cancer drug. It's a bit like a stress effect. You know, a cancer cell, they feel like they're being attacked by a cancer drug. And they start behaving differently to fight back.
Yeah.
And we developed a small molecule, a synthetic molecule, that targets a key protein that is important to drive, to govern these transcriptional changes. The small molecule is called TT125802. It's a little, we just call it 802. And so that prevents the cell from fighting back, basically. Mm-hmm. And hopefully that will also benefit patients then long term.
And if we stick to the software analogy, you know, you try to fix that issue, the software defect, but at the same time, you also want to make sure that you don't really affect anything else around the software to then cause a defect in a different area of the software. Mm-hmm. How do you make sure that this doesn't happen, that you really only focus on the cancer drug resistance and don't affect anything else?
Any healthy cell, right?
Yeah.
That's always the issue in cancer therapies. And that's how we try to develop modern cancer drugs. So chemotherapies, for instance, they're basically just cell poison derived from mustard gas. And you try to poison the tumor and kill it before you do too much harm to the patient. In our case, the mechanism we developed is a functional dependency. So it's not important for every cell. It's just important for cells, for cancer cells, that are very stressed. So you can think of it as, you know, good running shoes. If you're just sitting at home on the sofa doing nothing, it doesn't really matter what kind of shoes you're wearing. Your feet, at the end of the day, will be fine. If you run a marathon and you stress your system, then all of a sudden you become really dependent on good gear. Mm-hmm. And that's basically the situation we have in cancer. So these cancer cells are really stressed. They're really fighting for their survival. And that's when they become dependent on this mechanism that we can inhibit.
Amazing. Thank you for explaining everything so that we also as non-scientists can follow. That's fantastic. I also wonder, number-wise, how much does this actually impact a patient's long-term survival rate? Do you have any numbers to share?
Yeah, sure. So the indication that we will focus on is a so-called KRAS mutated non-small cell lung cancer, which means it's just a form of lung cancer that has a certain mutation. Mm-hmm. And for the past 30 years, it was a totally elusive drug target. This KRAS was very difficult to develop drugs against. And then a couple of years ago, finally, we had companies that were able to target it and the drugs were approved. And in the clinic, though, we saw that only 40% of patients actually profited from the drug. So only their tumors shrank. 60% of patients, their tumors, they didn't shrink. And those patients that did profit, they profited for about 5 to 6 months. And then their tumors came back. Yeah. So you come from this huge success and everybody's celebrating scientific discoveries. And then the clinical translation, though, is very disappointing. And that's not only the case for these KRAS inhibitors, but it's wherever we have so-called...
This episode was brought to you by Google Cloud, a partner that needs no introduction.
So it's anything between...
What you might not have heard of, though, is that Google offers a Google for Startups cloud program where they give you access to startup experts, technical training, business support, and cover your Google Cloud costs up to $200,000 for 2 years, or even $350,000 if you're an AI startup. Scale your startup faster and smarter with Google Cloud. Head over to goo.gle/Swisspreneur. Yeah, that's brutal, right? You think you're on the right path and then it hits you right back.
Exactly. That's what, you know, we saw a little bit with my co-founder, Willie, right? It was the same thing, you know, you have a year, you fight things, you think things are going better and then they don't, right? It's tough.
And you've also, of course, you're working on this, you've made some clinical progress. And I just want to talk a bit more about that because the development cycle is, of course, long in the area that you are operating in. Mm. You're now moving, if I'm not mistaken, to a phase one dose escalation study.
Yes.
What does that exactly mean? And where do you stand in terms of the development process?
So a phase one means that it's the very first stage of clinical development. When you develop a drug, you do a lot of work non-clinically to, you know, make sure that your drug is safe for patients. But then at one point you have to take the step and dose this synthetic molecule that you just designed and that's never been administered to a patient ever. And you give it to a patient for the first time, and especially in oncology, these are very, you know, sick people.
Of course.
And in a phase one, we want to understand the potential side effect of drugs to make sure that there is really sort of a risk-benefit ratio that's positive for patients. So that's what we're currently doing. And a dose escalation means that you start with a really, really low dose just to be on the safe side, that you don't hurt anybody. And then after you've dosed a couple of patients, 3 to 6, you increase your dose a little bit, you increase your dose a little bit. So you take small steps towards a so-called efficacious dose.
Got it. And is there sort of a predicted timeline for bringing the product to the market, you know, when people can buy it or actually use it, so to speak?
So there's probably never going to be a little box that says Tolremo on it.
No.
For a lot of biotechs that develop drugs, that's not a path you can go or want to finance. Because at one point your business model changes from heavy R&D, very science-driven, so you have to build a commercial organization and have global logistics and procurement. And so what a lot of biotechs do is you try to reach a certain proof of concept in the clinic, you know, signs that your drug actually works, actually helps patients. And then you would partner up with a larger organization that actually has all the downstream capabilities to bring the drug to the patient.
And partnering up in that regard probably means that you would get bought by this larger organization.
Depending on the structure, yes.
Okay, exactly. But most likely that's probably the scenario.
Oftentimes, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Got it. I also want to talk about the obstacles along the way, you know, of building your company to success. And the first one you already mentioned is this long development cycle. And I wonder here, along this long development cycle, you also need very different skill sets from different people. So how do you assemble but also change the team along that development cycle? That seems to be a huge challenge to solve.
It certainly is, right? I mean, the biotech model, the timelines are really long. The capital needed is really high and the risk is really high. So if you think about it, it's probably not the best career choice you can take. And these long development timelines also correlate with a lot of different activities that you have to do as you develop your drug. You know, we started out doing high throughput screens and doing a lot of image analysis and different algorithms. You go into actually building chemistry, to building preclinical models, to, and along this way, as an entrepreneur, you have to think of, okay, what is really our core expertise? So where do I need people in-house that want to keep on this journey with me? And what are expertises that we might need just for a relatively short period of time? So there you would rely on consultants. But also consultants, then, of course, you have to manage and you have to make sure that they're aligned with the in-house team. And that's a little bit the challenge that you have. It also helps, of course, regulate your burn a little bit, right? You can build everything in-house, but that'll shorten your runway a little bit. It's a challenge, but it's also interesting, right? Because you really get to think about how you want to build your organization.
Sure. How is that balanced then in practice? How many people do you employ in-house versus consultants or external people that you work with? Is there a certain ratio that you aim at or aim for?
I think in our case, it's probably about 1-to-1.
Okay. That's higher than I expected.
Right?
Yeah. Cool. And you also talked about the need for funding. You have raised a Series A, around $39 million. And just the funding, you know, you said it's a very risky journey. It takes a lot of time. How were you able to convince the investors that, hey, this is actually a good investment? It will take time. You probably have opportunity costs as well, right? If you invest with us, especially now this interest rates are rising again. How do you convince them to join your journey and invest this significant amount into your company?
I think usually people invest in the science. There needs to be a certain, you know, rationale. They invest mostly in teams, though. And for that, I mean, in the end, it's all about trust, right? As you say, they have opportunity costs. They can give their money to us or they can give their money to our competitors. So you need to find a way to show them that you're actually the team that can execute. And for that, building relationships with investors is key, especially when you don't need their money. Hmm. It's a little bit like dating, right? You don't want to ask somebody to marry on the first date, yeah, but you want to build that relationship. So you want to show them that you do deliver. So you show them what your plans are. And the next time you meet them that, you know, you show them that you've reached those milestones. And so they get a feel for you and how you operate and your company. That's super key.
And if I understand correctly what you mentioned at the very beginning, first, it's the team and also the track record of the team, sort of the famous professors joining, supporting, gives you some proof. And then you get the first money, and then it's all about execution and really showing that you deliver and that you're sort of a good horse to bet on.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah.
Fantastic. Do you have any tips in how to navigate that landscape? Because I feel many first-time entrepreneurs, they come up with these bold visions, right? They say, we want to go there, and then they struggle to deliver. There are always obstacles, of course, but how do you make sure that you don't overpromise and then cannot deliver, but actually do the opposite of underpromising and over-delivering, ideally?
Yeah, it's a difficult balance to strike, especially, I have to say, as a trained scientist, because you're somehow trained, you know, you never hypothesize, right? You just report what the actual data is. But as an entrepreneur, you have to show people aren't necessarily interested in your data per se. Mm-hmm. They're interested in the potential. What can you build out of this?
Yeah.
And there you have to be a little forward looking, right? So it is a difficult balance to strike. I do tend to be, I like to under promise and over deliver. I think it's really key for us founders, especially as first time founders, you know, out of academia, to surround yourself with good people who've done this before, who you can ask, who can also point out your blind spots to you, right? You can Google anything, but what about the things that you don't know that you shouldn't know? So how do you Google that? And I think that is so valuable.
Yeah.
And I think that's where also your board comes into play, right? Having a very experienced board that wants to help you build and not just govern.
Yeah, I love that. And another part to then also execute and get closer to the vision is partnerships. Mm. And I think they're really important for you, especially in your field. Mm. So how do you acquire partnerships as a startup where everybody might think, hey, you're too small, you're too young of a company, great idea, but you're just way too small for us to work with you. How do you also build the trust there, not only from a investor perspective, but actually to work with bigger companies and strike a partnership with them?
I think they're, again, similar to the investors. Super, super solid and exciting scientific data is very key because you have a lot of very smart people on all those sides, right? And of course, again, your network, right? I mean, we just hired a really, really experienced CBO to our team who's done exactly those deals, who knows who to call, and they actually pick up the phone and they have trust in her. And again, her joining our company validates what we do, right?
Yeah.
And I can really tell the difference pre-CBO and post-CBO, just sort of discussions we have.
Yeah.
All of a sudden you get to meet people at JP Morgan and they want to, you know, it's very, very different. Even though I'm showing them exactly the same data, I'm telling them exactly the same story, but it's just that validation.
Yeah, the story, the key people behind it are a bit different. That makes a huge difference.
Absolutely.
In that regard, I think that's also a sort of a good wake-up call for startups that these people, they don't come cheap. You have to incentivize them. You have to pay them because they have many other options, talking about opportunity cost again. So there you probably also have to make a significant investment as a company.
And that's exactly what it is, right? You invest in so many other things in your company. What you really have to invest in is your team, right? These are the people who help you build this.
And when you make such a bet, you usually only find out if it's really working out after you spent 1, 2, 3, maybe even 6 months together to, hey, do they really deliver? Are they really a big value add as you hope they will be? Mm-hmm. How do you sort of protect your company from a wrong hire?
I think it's very difficult to do that. At one point, you just have to take that leap of faith. Though I think it is important, so if you do realize that you hired, you know, maybe the right person, but you put them in the wrong position, that you need to take, there need to be consequences for you, right? You need to correct your course of action, because otherwise it's not satisfying for the person, it's not that satisfying for you. And again, it's that opportunity cost, which is really, really key.
It will be a lose-lose in the end for both parties,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Is there anything that you really watch out for before you make such a key hire as the CBO that you just described? Any sort of test or validation that it's not a guarantee, but maybe just sort of a reconfirmation that you're making a good hire?
I think to me, a lot comes down to gut feeling. You try to spend some time with them. You try to get a feel for them. Just their attitude in general, right?
Mm-hmm.
It can make such a huge difference. But there's no guarantees, unfortunately.
But I guess the more often you've done that, the better your gut feeling and your judgment also gets eventually.
Yeah, and you sort of start seeing red flags or, you know, where I did have some hires where like, oh, is this really the right decision? But, you know, you're positive. It's like, of course, you know, they'll be able to live it. And that cultural fit, right? I think the most we've gotten burnt is trying to get people from big pharma because they have all this experience and all these connections and put them into a biotech setting where, you know, they might be fantastic people, but they just can't function in that biotech environment, right?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know, taking a cactus and putting it in super wet soil. Yeah. It's just not a match.
Doesn't work.
Exactly. No.
Do you then more look for people who were setting up or working in biotech startups or younger companies before? Is that like a better fit than the traditional big pharma companies, for example?
I found so, yeah. And not necessarily young companies, but biotechs.
Okay.
Where they need to get their hands dirty, where you don't have these functional silos. Where...
Yeah.
And interestingly though, and maybe a little unfortunate for Switzerland, you do get a lot of that experience. A lot more, of course, in the States, where you have a much more mature biotech sector as opposed to Switzerland, where we just don't have that experience yet.
Yeah. So it does make a lot of sense. And why are you still here in Switzerland then and not in the US, for example?
It doesn't mean we'll stay here forever. Of course, you know, historical reasons. It's certainly cheaper over here.
Yeah.
The US, especially biotech, is extremely expensive. And I think we do have great talent here, but I'm a big fan of the hybrid. So we do have people in San Francisco, and then you just have to make it work.
Right. Yeah. The talent market is global.
Exactly. I think COVID taught us that, right?
Absolutely. So if we look at Tolerimo's mission, it's an incredibly important one. You seem to be well on track. And I wonder, what are sort of the next milestones that you want to achieve?
We need to advance our clinical trial to get to a setting where we can actually start combining with other cancer drugs.
Mm-hmm.
B, as always, you need more money. And C, what we touched on, ideally, we would do this in partnership with a large pharma company.
Got it. And talking about money, how do you make sure that you don't get diluted too much? That's also probably quite a delicate balance to strive for, right? Because you need money to build the company, but at the same time, you also don't want to, you know, get too diluted as a founding team, basically, I assume.
Personally, I don't worry too much about dilution. Yeah. You know, people always say, you know, have a smaller piece, have a bigger cake.
Classic, yeah.
What's important to me is that we can retain a certain degree of control, right? Mm-hmm. How we want to build this company. But dilution itself, you know, you need money to build something big and something nice and something attractive. And nobody's ever succeeded just saving money as much as they can.
So do you then sort of protect your voting rights with different share classes, for example, but have economic participation of the investors in case of a successful outcome?
Not really. I think it's just sort of the influence of personal relationships and that you build.
So it's basically very important to choose the right partners.
Absolutely. That's what makes or breaks a company.
And what is next for you, Stephanie? Of course, you are invested in the company, you have the next milestones to achieve, but for you personally, what is sort of the next step along that journey?
Personally, I'm looking forward to my skiing holidays in March.
Nice.
Just a little downtime, a little family time.
Yeah, that sounds perfect. And to wrap up the conversation today, we also prepared some rapid fire questions for you. I give you a short question or different options to choose from, and you have to answer in one sentence, ideally.
Okay.
Let's go. Researcher or entrepreneur?
Entrepreneur. A lot
more fun. Choice.
Yeah.
What has building Tolremo taught you so far?
The relative nature of the word impossible.
Nice. I like that. What do you wish you had known before you started Tolremo?
I suppose the opportunity cost of having the right person in the wrong position.
Okay. I guess that's probably sort of a journey that all founders or most founders go through, right?
Yeah.
Everyone can tell you. Yeah. And you just have to experience it. And the last one for you today, how often do you second guess yourself?
Often, almost daily. You need to keep growing, right?
Yeah. But it's also a balance there, I guess.
Yeah, of course, it can't be paralyzing. No. But I always, you know, it's important to surround yourself with people who you know and you ask, and then you can evaluate, do you listen to them or not?
No.
But it's important to keep asking, I think.
Fantastic. Stephanie, thank you so much for coming on the show. It was a pleasure talking to you. And all the best and lots of success for the future.
Thanks for having me.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, you can support us by rating our show on Apple Podcasts. This way, we can reach an ever-growing number of aspiring entrepreneurs.